The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers followed by our information break, and then our main speaker who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker is Debbie.
Hi, I'm Debbie. I'm an alcoholic. I never imagined that I would be saying that here. And my sobriety date is April 20th, 2016, and there's no significance to the fact that it's 420 at all. I had 61 days and I drank and started counting days again. I have a sponsor, Jennifer H., who I'm very grateful for, and I'm right now on steps 9 and 10. And start. I started drinking when I was 14 years old, and I feel like that seems to be kind of the magic number I hear coming to meetings. I grew up in an alcoholic home outside of Boston. My mother was an alcoholic, pretty severe alcoholic. My dad, she would be, either falling downstairs, passed out in the bathroom, and my dad, he liked to go to, drink at bars, and so oftentimes on a Saturday night when he'd come pick us up after they were divorced, we'd end up at a bar restaurant Saturday night, and he would give us, my sister and I, quarters to go play pinball, and he'd sit at the bar, and so there was a lot of violence and chaos and abuse growing up in an alcoholic home. And my way of dealing with it was to drink, just to escape. And my goal was to get sloshed. And I would tell my friends that. I'd say, I'm getting, wicked drunk tonight. I blacked out, the very first time I drank, I remember being with my friend Mary, and we bought a six-pack. And I remember I drank three beers, vomited, and then drank three more. And I didn't enjoy it, but I did grow to enjoy it. I really liked it. I thought it was a lot of fun. It helped me get out of myself. It helped me what I thought was like to be myself. I was really shy as a child, and I felt like it made me the life of the party. Made friends and. But I did. I blacked out, and there was one particular night. My friend Pam slept over, and I asked her the next morning, I said, how did we get home? And she said, you drove. And I had absolutely no recollection. But I didn't feel like I was doing anything any differently than anybody else was. The parties in the suburbs of Boston consisted of, getting in a car, driving it to an industrial park, the cops chasing us out, and then going to the next industrial park, or going behind the 7-Eleven. And for me, it always included vomiting and I didn't think that I was doing anything that differently until I just made my first amends to my friend Pam. And when I talked to her, she didn't remember it, but she had told me that she only passed out and vomited once, and I couldn't believe that. I just thought, so that's like, my drinking wasn't the same. But I continued to do it, and I moved to New York in 91, and I was pursuing a career where there was a lot of partying, and we'd get paid and drink tickets, and I thought that was great, and I would be out till 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning and then go to my day job, fall asleep. My coworker would see me sleeping, and she'd call me to wake me up before my boss would see me. I got suspended from like 3 jobs without pay, because I was late, but I never thought it had anything to do with my drinking at all. It was just, when I was out at night, I was having so much fun, I didn't want to stop. I wasn't a daily drinker, but more of a binge drinker, so once I picked up a drink, I just wanted to keep going. And when I was thirsty, I was like, instead of getting water, I need another drink. This whole time, I was going to Al-Anon, because for my mother's drinking. And when I would hear people speak about alcohol, my ears would perk up, because I'm like, I really want to hear people talk about their drinking. So I was in Al-Anon for a long time. And my Al-Anon sponsor asked me at one point to go back to the first step, and she asked me to write my history with alcohol. And I knew something was up. It's like, this isn't going to look good for me. So I wrote my history with alcohol, and I sat down with her, and she said, do you think you have a problem with alcohol? And I said, no. And because there's just no way that I was going to work two programs. And I couldn't wrap my head around it. And my mother had died in 2007 from alcoholism. She was in and out of the hospital for dehydration, and what finally took her was that she hit her head outside of her apartment. Her neighbors tried to get to the hospital. She said no, and she died that night. And that was the first time I questioned my relationship with alcohol or even thought that I had a relationship with alcohol. And so then I decided, you know what, I better keep an eye on this, and I wouldn't drink more than like two drinks for a while. And then I didn't realize this until just recently, that I was like controlled drinking by, you know, drinking the water in between. And but then, you know, it kind of got to a point where, so when I met my Al-Anon sponsor, I continued to drink for 3 years after that. And I didn't stop until a guy that I was dating broke up with me because of my drinking, which I thought was absolutely absurd. I thought he was being uptight, and I only had three beers. But the thing was, they were like high in alcohol content. I like considered myself a beer enthusiast. I loved craft beer, and the higher the alcohol content, the better. And I actually had the nerve to tell him that I've put up with so much worse from alcoholics. And, what's not in my story, I didn't go to rehab. I don't have jails, institutions, death in my story. And I remember I told my sponsor, I was like, this is the first thing I've ever lost from drinking with this guy. And she was like, well, what about your mother? And I was like, well, then there was that. I said that I would go to an AA meeting. None of that stuff had happened. I had done all kinds of stupid things. Like, I feel like the worst thing I did was, like, I stole a bar stool from a bar one night on the Lower East Side, and I took it on the M15 bus all the way up to the Upper East Side. And then I went into a deli and stole a can of beefaroni and left my bar stool and went home. Forgot about it, and I was really bummed out the next day. but those, you know, not the way you want to live. And, you know, I did other, you know, lots of embarrassing things. And so I went to an AA meeting, and I was really coming here to make sure that I wasn't an alcoholic, because I could not fathom the idea of never drinking again. It was just so much a part of my life with my friends and my family. I ended up at the Friday night AG meeting. I was counting days. I had 21 days. And I wasn't willing to say that I was an alcoholic. It took me a good 4 months. I'm so grateful for the third tradition, or I would never be here. I just couldn't say it. Because if I was an alcoholic, that meant death. I know I wasn't going to turn into my mother, and I just didn't think that I was. I met my sponsor that night. I was standing with four women, and one woman said, do you have a sponsor? And I said, no. And Jennifer said, I'm available to be your interim sponsor. And so we started working the steps. We started looking at the big book and met once a week. She suggested to get service commitments, and I did that right away, but I was kind of, you know, my first was a greeting commitment up on the Upper West Side. And I remember just being so afraid of it. I was like, I don't want to say hi to people. And I don't know why that was so daunting, because I've been doing it for years, but it just seemed really scary to me. I co-chair some meetings, and this is such a beautiful group, and it's become a family, and it's just to come in here and see people working with their sponsees. What made me able to admit that I was finally an alcoholic was just all the reading in the books, the 12 and 12. Unfortunately, in the 12 and 12, the thing I related to the most was the depressive, you know, the depressive person who can, like, what is it, like a boggy mess or something that I just wallowed in self-pity. lot of like self-pity, fear, and that's what the steps have really helped me with, is to just let go of all the anger that I had. And I guess just to, you know, help me to see what really going on, you know, like, this was the key that really helped me. I feel like it's a medicine for me that has just helped me. I needed to get to know like who I was without alcohol, and to trust in a higher power. I always felt like I had a higher power. I just don't feel like I'd be here, and I questioned, like, you know, why am I here? And I really believe that my higher power led me here, and gave me like a second chance, maybe a third, maybe a fourth. And I think part of my amends to my mother is being able to be here. I just made an amends to my dad, and it was just simply telling him that I think I have a problem with alcohol and I'm in AA. I expected him to read my mind this whole time while I wasn't drinking, and it's just really helped me to get honest with myself. And I love the part in the big book about being able to look the world in the eye. I think like it's the first time. I've always was looking up to people, looking down on myself most of the time. And, you know, that worker among workers. And so I just want to say thank you to all of you. Thank you, Nicole, for asking me to speak. And I'm happy to say that I have a sober family now that I'm going to have dinner with tonight. Okay, thanks.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Austin.
Thanks. I'm Austin. I'm an alcoholic. Hi. Debbie, thank you. That was great. Kelly, looking forward to hearing you. It's a privilege to be up here. It's cool. Like, it feels very good. I had like 20 people, some of whom I didn't even know, come up to me and say, "Don't be nervous. You're going to do great." And it's like such a great testament of like the unconditional love that we have in here. For part of my job, I talk in front of people. I don't know what I'm doing wrong at work, but I've never had anybody come up to me and say, "Boss, you're going to do great. Like, we love you. Don't worry about it." But it's great to feel that love. If you're new and you don't feel that yet, I can relate. I came into AA like an animal. I was angry. I was frustrated. I had been coming in and out for 7 years, and I did not want to be here. It took a lot for me to reach out and ask for help. So if you're new and you're feeling like, "I don't want to be here, I'm hurting, this isn't fun," you're probably in the right place, and please reach out for help. It will end up helping the person that you ask almost as much as it'll help you. So let's see. I don't remember my first drink. For a while, I thought that made me different than other alcoholics. It doesn't. I just don't remember. But I do remember reaching a point where I like fell in love with the feeling produced by alcohol. I went through life kind of feeling like that kid who missed like the first couple days of school and then like got in and was like, "I don't really know what's going on. Like, why am I weird? I don't feel right. Everybody knows something I don't know." But as soon as I drank, that quickly cured that problem. The problem is that the side effects, you know, alcohol is a phenomenal cure for alcoholism. For me, the side effects were very devastating. I got into a lot of trouble, and I got sober for the first time very young. I got into like a very dark spot, and I'm happy to talk to anybody, but not from the podium. But I got into a lot of trouble, and things didn't go well. And I went off to treatment, and I came back, and I went to AA, and my life changed dramatically for the better. I wasn't in trouble anymore. I had a sponsor. I had started to work the steps. And I found a fellowship in AA that I've been looking for my whole life. And it worked better than what I had found in drinking. You would imagine that after that statement I would say, and then I did that for the rest of my life, and I was a happy guy. I didn't. What happened was I stopped going to meetings, I stopped calling a sponsor, and I got into the mindset of, I did this. I did all this. I don't need you guys. I'm better than you guys. And I spent about 3 more years not drinking, but totally insane. And that's an interesting thing about an alcoholic like me is if I stop drinking, my life doesn't actually get substantially better. Like, if I don't have another solution like AA, my life actually gets much worse. So the only time I've ever been arrested, I was 4 years sober. I probably crashed 5 cars, 6 years sober. I was very angry. If anybody here was ever drunk and drinking at an Upper East Side bar and some random guy ran up and hit you and he appeared to be sober, I'll make amends to you later. But I was like a very, very angry guy. Because I didn't know how to live. I knew I couldn't drink, which was my solution, and I knew I couldn't, and I didn't want to go back to AA because I was embarrassed, I felt distant, I didn't feel connected. So eventually I ended up breaking my toe. I went to see a doctor, he gave me some stuff, and that caused a spiral where I was going shopping in Mexico every month and coming back and so on and so forth. After about a year of that kind of behavior, I said, I just got to start drinking again because I'm going to die from all this other stuff. Like, drinking is the next logical option. And, you know, people talk about it. They say, when I thought about drinking, I thought about being able to have one glass of brandy in a wood office or something like that. I don't know. Like, I never had that thought. I never thought I would like to be able to have one drink. I thought I would like to be able to drink this case of liquor and not get in so much trouble, and maybe I can control how much trouble I get into. I never figured out a way. I don't think there is one. I then spent the next, let's say, 7 years coming in and out of AA. And when I kind of think about it, I think I probably tried to use AA in a certain sense to try and manage my alcoholism. Like, I would get in trouble, I'd go to AA meetings, I'd say I'm in AA meetings, things would get better, I'd get out of trouble, and I'd go back out. And I had a really good kind of ability to do that. You know, get in trouble, AA, get out of trouble, go back out. I did, however, something shifted in my drinking where I reached a point where I could no longer control and enjoy my drinking. It became either really enjoy my drinking and let go of all control, or try and control it and have no fun. And that quickly progressed me to a kind of a much darker and less fun place. Like, drinking was fun at first. If it wasn't, I wouldn't do it. But towards the end of my drinking, I reached a place where it was sad. I had friends who passed away, and we were both trying to get sober, and it was, you know, really painful. It wasn't painful at the time. At the time, I was like, whatever, I'm going to go get drunk. But it was painful afterwards. So things got pretty dark. I moved around a bunch. I tried to live in different places. And I was in and out of AA. I was the guy in the AA room who is disturbing the meeting. God bless AA. Like, I was never told you can't come back. I was told, like, you can watch the meeting through the window, but you can't be in the room. But, like, AA never turned its back on me. Like, ever. There was always a seat here for me. There was always somebody to listen to me. There was always that sense of unconditional love. I finally got sober. So I finally said that I got sober in November of 2008, and I was about to celebrate a year at a meeting like this, and I had to go to my sponsor and say, I've been drinking like 24 O'Douls a day and taking a bunch of other stuff. Like, does that count? It doesn't. It didn't, you know. He said, did I know this be true, which meant no. But I was given something kind of over this period of drinking and waking up and feeling that, as they say, the bitter morass of self-pity and feeling like, God, I hope I get hit by a bus. I don't have the courage to kill myself, but I'd love to die. And towards the very end of that, I got something that was the most beautiful gift I could have ever gotten, was I got an incredible amount of pain and desperation and fear. And at the time, I would have been like, I said, like, this is the worst thing I've ever felt. But now, like, I can look back and say, like, that was the most beautiful thing that I've been given. because it really gave me a chance to, like, I need to do this. And I moved and I went back to Virginia, which is where I had gotten sober the first time, and I found a home group. And, you know, when Debbie spoke, she talked about having a home group or sobriety date, sponsor, all that kind of stuff. And those were the things that I got that helped keep me sober. One, I got a sponsor, and this was a guy who, like, wanted what I had. Like, I looked at his life and I was like, he looks happy, I'm going to kill myself, I want what he has. It was, like, that simple. He never said to me, like, I'm your sponsor. I had to, like, ask him. But he, like, started acting like a sponsor from the first day I met him. He was like, we're going to a meeting tomorrow, we're going to go to a meeting tomorrow, get in the car. And he taught me something really interesting about AA that was, I mean, indirectly. So when I came into AA, I had a kind of negative disposition towards a higher power. And I think I probably emulated, like, some paternal human characteristics on God. And I was like, well, God is mean, and maybe he's not going to love me, and I'm in trouble, and this and that. And what a home group and what a sponsor taught me was about that unconditional love. And then that allowed me to form a relationship with a higher power, because I thought, if these people here can love me unconditionally, and if this guy can love me unconditionally, well, maybe that's how my higher power feels about me. And that was a beautiful thing, because I went from thinking, this guy hates me, he's mad at me, to great, I have a great relationship. Sobriety date, like I said, I had to change mine. I think it's an important milestone to have. And a home group. A home group was really important for me when I first got sober, and it still is now. Somewhere where I can go and, like, it is literally home for me. Like, everything in the world can be terrible, and I know I can come to my home group, and there's somebody there who has the experience that I'm feeling right now and will share with me. So those are the things that I really enjoyed having. You know, I came to AA to stop drinking, and the reality was that AA has had the ability to fix every single thing in my life. Like, people say this, and I used to roll my eyes, but, like, literally every good thing in my life right now is a direct result of Alcoholics Anonymous. Like, I did none of it. I just followed what you guys told me to do. So thank you so much for my sobriety.
Our main speaker tonight is Kelly.
Hi, my name is Kelly, and I'm an alcoholic. First, I want to thank Adam for asking me to speak. I was supposed to come speak on the 30th of January, and then he asked me if I could speak tonight instead because the other person was sick, and I was so glad because then I didn't have, like, 3 more weeks to think about this. So I was done. So now I'm like, can't wait. No, but I love, this is, you know, I got sober in this meeting 18 years ago. My sober date is 9/9/99. And I didn't pick it. I didn't pick that date. I didn't even realize that was my sober date for a long time. Like, I had the day planner that, you know, that you used to write down in. I had the day planner, and I would keep track of my days in the day planner of how much time I had, because it's not going to stay in my head. So then all of a sudden, this guy that I got sober with started to have more days than I had. And I was like, what's wrong with him? What's going on? Why does he have more? And what I realized was that I forgot to count weekends. I only counted the weekdays, so I had no idea. I was completely a mess. So I had no idea what my sober date was, but that's what it is, and I love it. It's great. So that's my sober date. I have a sponsor. Her name is Mary, and she lives in Montana. And my home group is the No Serenity Till Brooklyn group. And let's see what else. I'm 42 years old. I'm married to a woman, and I have twin boys. Done. So so anyways, and I didn't always date women, and that'll come up in my story if that's another question you have. So you know, I started drinking young at 13 years old. My first drink was a blackout, completely. My friend had some sort of whatever. We made martinis, right? Like the martini, and my parents drank martinis. So I had gin, vodka, Coca-Cola, something else, whatever, and this is my drink. We had one each. She took a sip and said, this is disgusting, and wouldn't drink anymore. I drank mine, hers, and then went down for more. blacked out, have no clue, but something involving like throwing scissors occurred on my part. Like I got crazy. When I drink, I have no idea what will happen, and I love it. You know what I mean? I love that feeling of like just not caring about anything. I grew up in a fine home. I love my parents today. It was like a white picket fence in upstate New York. There was nothing wrong with my upbringing, but when I drank alcohol, I loved the way I felt. And what happened for me is that it progressed to the point that I had no control over how much I took. And to me, that is what powerless is, and that defines me as an alcoholic. My powerlessness over alcohol is the most important thing to me. And I didn't quite realize that until I was sober for a long period of time. Like, yeah, I can tell you what the big book says about alcoholism, but I didn't understand how important it was to realize that I was completely powerless over alcohol. Like, probably until recently. And I could say, oh, I don't really remember what happened when I tried to stop drinking, which I really didn't try to stop drinking often, but, you know, ever really. But what happened when I drank, right? That's the one I could relate to. What happened when I drank? Could I ever control the amount I took when I drank? I didn't get that for a long time. And today, that's what defines me as an alcoholic. And I know that through and through. And I need to remember from 18 years ago what happens when I take that drink, or else I'm much more at risk for thinking it might be a good idea to take a drink today, that it's a phase that I went through at a young age, or that it's whatever, you know. So for me, it's so incredibly important to understand that powerlessness. I was powerless over alcohol. I loved the effect it gave me. I drank and I felt like I didn't feel. It was fantastic. And, you know, I did that for a while. There was nothing crazy in my early, you know, drinking. It worked and it was fun, and I went out with friends, and then I went away to college. And I went from upstate New York to Washington, D.C., and that was like a whole new world for me, because there was no driving, there was no nothing. I could get around with taxis, I could go anywhere and get drunk. And so when I went to school, I got this job very early on as a cocktail waitress, and it was in like this really cool acid jazz lounge. It was like the place to be in Washington, D.C. in the 90s. And I was like, they wouldn't let other college students in there, right? The door was like reflective, whatever, and nobody had to look a certain way to come in. And like I had arrived in this like amazing acid jazz lounge, right? And I'm a cocktail waitressing, and it was great. I had such a good time. I had a great time. And I would get tipped in alcohol, drugs, everything I wanted. I had comforters nailed to my window pane so that no sunlight ever came in. And I had this beautiful apartment with like floor-to-ceiling windows that looked out over the Washington Monument, but I never saw it really. So like nailed, and no light could ever get in. My house was the after party, and like I hated the sunlight. Hate when it rained and it was dark all day. I was like, oh, I can go outside now, you know. Like I didn't want to ever feel like that. So. You know, that was fun for me. That sounds terrible, but that was fun for me. And so, you know, eventually what happened was I didn't know, like Austin was talking about, I was angry inside a lot of times when I drank, and that anger would come out. And I would do anything. I didn't care. I wanted to have a good time. I did not care about anybody. And so, one night, this one woman had called me some word, and when I found out about it, I pushed her down the stairs. And they were really long stairs from top to bottom. And turned out that she was a lawyer. and I was fired from that job, obviously, and they pretended they didn't know me and who I was, and I could never go back there ever again. And I was lived in fear that I was going to be arrested walking around the campus. You know, I was just petrified. And then I just went at that time just from job to job where I could waitress and, you know, do whatever to drink while I was working, and that kind of fed my habit. And so I graduated college. I'm not entirely sure how, but I did. And, you know, at the time, I had a boyfriend of like a couple of years, and he said he was going to tell my mom if I didn't do something about my drinking. Oh, what I forgot to tell you is that I grew up in a very Catholic home, right? My mother was a nun for 18 years, and she left the convent, and then she met my father. My dad was not a priest. They met 6 months later. There was no scandal there. She was like a very good woman. And so she is a good woman. She's still alive. And she's still a good woman. And so, anyway, they met, whatever. They couldn't have kids. I'm adopted. And then, so I grew up in this very strict home. I just had the train of thought, right? So I grew up in this very strict home. And, like, you did not cross my mom with a Catholic mother, you know? Like, it was very, you just had to be very, very, you know, like, this is how it was. I don't even remember where I was going with that train of thought. But anyway, that's okay. Oh, yeah, boyfriend, right, thank you. So, I forgot about him. So, anyway, so what would happen? So he said, I'm going to tell your mom. So I was, like, petrified of my mother, right? Like, totally afraid of my mother. So, no, I was going to tell her first. In this one weak moment of being, of like, oh, maybe I have a problem, which I didn't believe, but, like, multiple people had told me I needed to do something about the drinking, and multiple people's mothers had told me. So this one was going to tell my mom, so I was like, okay, no. In a weak moment, I told my mother that I think I might have a problem with alcohol. I didn't believe it, but I didn't know what else to do. I was, like, literally, like half living with a Coke dealer and, like, couldn't function without, like, a couple 40s and then some liquor on the side. Like, I was in a bad place, and I still didn't think that was the problem. So I moved home, and I went to my first meeting. My mom took me to my first meeting, and it was in upstate New York. There was, like, 10 men, mostly older men, and, like, maybe, like, one tooth collective in all of the men there. And I don't know anything that happened, but at the end they asked if anyone new wanted to say anything. Like, there's nobody else but me and my mom. And anyone new want to say anything. And my mother raises her hand, and I'm like, oh God. I was so nervous. And so she said, I just think it's so wonderful how all of you share your feelings here and come together like this. And I was mortified. And someone came up to me after the meeting and said, there's another meeting on Saturday if you want to come. There's some other younger people here. So I took my brother to that meeting. Mom's not coming with me again. So I took my younger brother to that meeting with me. And then I, like, got sober. But I'm laughing because when Austin was sharing, I was drinking O'Doul's and doing other things. But I thought I was sober, and I totally forgot about that O'Doul. Like, 24, yeah, just to get the little buzz. I really thought I was sober, drinking O'Doul's as many as I could. I was, like, had to pee every 2 seconds. But I was, like, you know, I was, so that was my idea of what sober was. And I had these two sponsors that I never called, and I had this cookie commitment that my mother made cookies for, and, like, this was how it went, you know. And then I get this job in New York as an NBC page. And so I moved to New York, and it took me probably about, I don't know, let's see. I moved, okay, so it probably took me 2 months, and then I went out. And I drank for another year, and that drinking was very different than the prior. And this is really how I know today, through and through, I'm an alcoholic. At first it was, I'm just going to drink on the weekends. And then it was, I'm just going to drink when I'm out. And then it was, well, I better just buy alcohol and keep it at my house because it's way too expensive when I go out. So I was drinking in my house alone, fearful, petrified of everything. I could hardly leave my house without alcohol. And I had gone into a four-day blackout. I had visited Washington, D.C. I visited a friend of mine, gone into a blackout, came out of that blackout and didn't know what was happening to me, and I was detoxing. I had no idea. And I had never felt that way before because I had never gone without drinking, you know, not during that year period. And so I started to have this rising panic. And I thought that I didn't know what was going to happen, but just like Bill talks about in the Big Book, that feeling of wanting to jump out of the window. He put his mattress on the floor for fear of jumping out, sash and all, you know. And I understood that feeling so well because that was exactly how I felt. I worked on the 42nd floor at that time. I wanted to jump out. I couldn't stay in my skin, and I didn't understand. Alcohol didn't work. I would take a drink, and it didn't work anymore. It didn't calm the nerves. It didn't work. And so I went to the employee assistance department at my job thinking that if I could just get some sleeping pills, I would be okay. And instead, I got Stephanie. Stephanie called me up at my job, and I didn't know her then, but she calls me and she asked me to meet me at 86th and Broadway on a Friday night so she could take me to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. Like, I have no recollection of saying yes. Like, that was not my intention. I was like, what are you talking about? But I just said yes. And that, to me, is divine intervention. That was my moment. I was given a gift. And I don't know why I said yes and why some people don't. I have no idea, but I did. I said, yes, I'll meet you. I come bouncing up the stairs of the subway, meet her. She takes me to a meeting, and I follow her. And I met my sponsor 7 days later, who's a member of this group, and then I came to this group. So this when I walked into this church, I've like really felt at home because I remember coming here every week and just this being here is what made me who I am today. It gave me this strong foundation of sobriety, this desire to seek something bigger and continue to seek and not be stagnant where I am, but continue to want to be better, be more humble, and be more compassionate. And I want to read something that I read this morning in the daily reading from the Grapevine. This morning, if some of you get that, you can get the email. It's really great, but I loved this. It says, January 16, 2018, rigorous action coupled with conscious reflection and human compassion will gain me new opportunities for greater hope and harmony with all those I deal with, even ones with whom I disagree. And, you know, that just kind of, for me, really sums up what I've learned in this room. And, you know, throughout my sobriety, I've had some big ups and downs, and I'll talk a little bit more about those. I did the step work. Like, in my head, it was like I did everything she told me. But I don't really think I did that. I think I didn't do everything. But I did what she asked me to do, even though sometimes I questioned it. She would always answer my questions and explain things to me because I wanted to know why. You know, I always wanted to know why. And she took the time. She really took the time. And she understood what it talks about in the Big Book about how I know to sponsor someone. I go to meet that person where they are and learn what they need and how they can hear me. That's what I've learned from the Big Book. I try to figure out how is that person best going to be able to hear me. you know, what do they need? What can I provide that they need? And so that's what she did for me. And she answered all my questions in my insanity. And some days she was just like, Kelly, I can't deal with you. And she would like walk away. And like, I'd have to, I know, like people, but she had to, because I was a crazy, you know, I would ask why everything and write it. You know, I'd have to write, okay, go talk to somebody else about it. And so I talked to Ava about it all the time. So I love Ava. Thank God for Ava. So, So what I learned to do was to do this work and have a strong foundation, and not just do the work because it tells me to do it, but do it because I believe in it. Do it because I really believe that my sponsor had this spiritual awakening, and maybe someday I could have that. And I believed all these people here had this change. And I saw people changing. And I didn't want to be who I was. I didn't like that person. For me, I really wanted to, I didn't know it, but I wanted to be humble. I wanted to be a better person. And I think that, like, that's what I continue to try to strive for, and I'll never be at a place where I am. And so when that sponsor moved away, I got into nursing school, and I made nursing school my priority. And, you know, I had a sponsor at the time who said, you don't have to make this amend. You don't have to do this one. That's okay. Don't do this one. Don't do this one. And my experience today is that's not the way that I practice the program. I think, you know, we go through these amends, but I do every single one of them possible. And I don't cross them off the list. I just don't. I figure out how to do them, you know, and that's been life-saving. And I was listening to Mark H. today, and he's one of my favorite speakers, and he was talking about how, he was talking about the liberation of having every single one of your amends completed. And I don't know if you guys have that experience, but I do. And that allowed me to feel like that I'm not so bad. That I'm not so bad, and I get a second chance at this life. And allowed me this clean slate so that I can provide other people with love. I can look people in the eye and say, what do you need? And I don't have to worry about all these things inside of my head. And gave me true humility and helped me to learn what that really means, what it really means to feel horrible about my behavior and know that I cause pain when I act in self. And so I ended up not doing those amends, not making meetings a priority, but I was still sponsoring people. And what happened was I thought it was a good idea to get into a relationship with my sponsee. And she was a few days sober, but I thought I was going to tell her how I felt and that was more important than anything else. And she drank. We were together for a long time, and I created way more havoc, like Austin was talking about, than I ever had when I was drinking. Not only her life, her girlfriend's life, her family's life, and everybody else around. And I thought I was fine. I thought I wasn't, I knew maybe I wasn't doing something so great, but I still felt justification for what I was doing. And I was in that relationship for a long time, and it, you know, I, to this day, realize that I created so much wreckage and may have aided in ruining a chance for her to be sober. I've since made amends to her and her ex-girlfriend, which is really hard, but one of the most rewarding things I've done. She heard me and she forgave me, both of them. I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe it that they could actually forgive me for doing those things. You know, I ripped the carpet out from under both of their lives and didn't care and took what I wanted. and justified that. I robbed them of their emotional security. And I didn't drink during that time, but again, I caused way more wreckage than I could have ever imagined I would. And so when we talk about, and when I hear other people talk about getting a lot sicker when we get sober without the program, I can relate to that because that's me. I am a mess. And when I'm not working this program, as outlined in the big book, and I take that very seriously, and it's not just, oh, it's okay if you don't write inventory today. It's okay if you don't pray and meditate today. It's never okay for me. It doesn't mean I don't have days that I forget or I skip it. It's not that, but it's not okay. My bar that I set for myself is way higher up here. And I try to achieve that bar every day. So if I'm not working towards all of the directions in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, then I'm sick. Me. I'm sick. I don't know about anybody else, but that's my experience. And I'm in trouble. And then that means that I create wreckage and I'm the tornado for everybody else around me. I don't want to do that today. So my best friend said to me, I was sitting in the back, all the way in the back, and I had come back to the rooms a little bit during this relationship because it was so horrible. I mean, hello, of course. I was sitting in the back, and she said, "Are you even sober?" It hurt so bad. But I'm so grateful for that phrase, that thing that she said to me, because it got me to be like, really? Yeah, I'm sober. It got me to do the work and look at where I was. That's where I was. That's where I was. Are you even sober? No, I wasn't. I was an untreated alcoholism. And so that got me to get this sponsor and get back into the work really intensely. And I kicked and screamed again, but I knew. And then nobody would listen to me if I did, because they're like, no, you what? Like, look at your life. You're telling me how bad it is. Just do it then. Who cares if you have to go to a meeting, every single meeting they ask you to go to? Who cares? Just do it and see what happens. You know, my ideas were not working. And so I did. And I reworked the steps. And, you know, I've had a couple different sponsors throughout my sobriety. And that's just what it is. That's just how it's been for me. And I learn something every time. And so I really started to work, and I went back to my original sponsor that I got sober with, and I did everything. I was going to do everything she said. And I did. I did everything she said for me to do. And that was it. My life turned around, you know, slowly but surely turned around. And I met my wife from Match.com, and you know, when I met her, I was able to look at this person and look at not what I could get out of the relationship, not come to the relationship as like someone that was broken with all this baggage, but come to the relationship as a whole person who had thoroughly worked the steps again in my sobriety as a sober individual. And I came to that relief, and it was wonderful, right? It was great and wonderful, but it wasn't that like excitement beyond excitement. It was I just knew it was right. And we ended up getting married, and I got pregnant with twins, and we have twin boys now. They're 7 years old. So, what the work has continued to do for me is keep me sane with twin boys, which is really difficult. Really difficult. If any of you have children in sobriety that are difficult, like, please, I understand, and you can come talk to me. We can talk. But I'm in this relationship, and the relationship can be very difficult. There are a lot of difficulties. I'm like, I'm not easy, right? I'm not easy to be with. And so we had to do a lot of work together in our relationship and separately as well. And things are kind of up and down, and we've had a lot of things happen. In my sobriety, I've had a scare of lung cancer, and they had to take out a piece of my lung. I've had multiple surgeries in sobriety with all different types of outcomes. And I don't have cancer, but these are all things that are serious things that we have to deal with, and I wouldn't have been able to deal with them without having this foundation in a sane manner. And so I remember laughing, like, you got a little lung cancer. That's what we said when I found out, my sponsor and I, so we deal with it. It's fine. The next thing. And my wife had a cardiac event in the middle of the night in my bathroom. And I really thought she was dead. And instead of hysteria, I was able to be calm, do the next steps, call the paramedics. We went to the hospital. Things have moved out. She's okay. And then, we have preemie kids that were born at 31 weeks very early in the NICU for a month. We've had a lot of things go on, and all of you do too, I'm sure, and it's not to say that mine are different. That's just what they were for me, and those things were really difficult, and I thought that I'd never be able to deal with things like this, but I was. I was able to deal with them and feel like I was able to deal with them very sanely in a partnership with my wife. And I'm allowed to share this. She told me I could. But today we have this amazing home where she's in Al-Anon and I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous. And so, I'm gonna cry. So we have an environment to provide our children with, like, this sober environment. And one of my little sons is going through this difficult time. He's like, I hate myself. I'm so stupid. And he's saying all these really sad things that, like, just break my heart. But Kim and I know how to deal with that because we have programs. And they're growing up around the 12 steps. So they're not alone. We know what to do. And we can lead by examples so that they have an idea of how to handle this stuff that comes up. And so I'm incredibly, incredibly grateful and humbled. I'm also I'm a nurse practitioner today, and I'm in a PhD program, and I feel so incredibly blessed to be able to take care of patients daily and make my life about service. I take care of patients who are dying. I'm in palliative care. And I can't believe that I get to do that and sit and mourn with people. And it's all because of me being present in this program and learning how to listen and learning how to be receptive to people and be receptive to love and give love. So thank you so much for having me tonight, and thank you for my sobriety.